This message, titled Hedged In by God from Hosea chapter 2, verses 1 through 13, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com.
Brothers and sisters, perhaps you're familiar this morning with that golden truth that the prophet Isaiah spoke. Perhaps you remember when Isaiah tells us, or rather God himself tells us through the prophet Isaiah, that the ways of God are higher than our ways. That the thoughts of God are higher than our thoughts. That God, brothers and sisters, he is not like you and he is not like me, but his ways and his thoughts are higher than our thoughts and our ways. And this morning I praise God that it is so, because he is the one who is the ultimate object of our faith. He is the one who is the ultimate object of our trust. And I wonder this morning, just by way of introduction, if you could imagine for a moment, if you were asked to put your ultimate trust in someone just like yourself. Can you imagine the horror of having to put all of eternity on the shoulders of someone who thinks just like you? Someone whose ways are just like your ways. Someone who is as ignorant as you are. Someone who is as weak as you are. Someone who is as inconsistent, as foolish, someone who is as sinful as you are. Friends, that would not be a faith worth having. If God is to be God, and a God who is worshipped and served, and a God who is trusted, then let us praise him this morning that his ways are higher than our ways, and his thoughts are so much higher than our thoughts. In trying to preach this morning from the text before us, I want to endeavor to show you something of that truth. Something, you might say, of the mysterious ways of God, the mysterious thoughts of God. I want to remind you, as we've come to this second chapter, that what we have in this prophecy, somewhat distinct from the first chapter, which was largely descriptive, here in the second chapter of this prophecy, we have something that is more prescriptive. We have a word that comes to the people of Israel through the mouth and the ministry of Hosea that is intended not simply to describe their situation, but to prescribe for them a remedy. You remember we saw that last week, that this word comes to us as a correcting word. Despite all of their unfaithfulness, despite of all of their spiritual adultery, God still desires that his people would put off their sin. That they would put off their spiritual adultery. And in putting off their sin, that they would be spared from God's relentless coming judgment. And here in the second chapter, we begin to see with a little more clarity, we begin to see with a little more precision what it is that Israel had done. How it is, you might say, that Israel played the part of a spiritual whore, turning from God, and turning to prostitute herself out. And we see with great clarity. This morning, I'm not going to preach every word of these verses that we've read. But what I do want you to see as we work through these words are really what I want to call, or rather, let me put it this way, I want to make four connections for you from these words. I want you to see the way this morning that prosperity is connected to forgetfulness. Then I want to show you this morning from these words how forgetfulness is connected to the hardness of heart. And then I want to show you how hardness in these words is connected to affliction. And finally, how affliction is connected to remembering. So those are the four connections that I want to make this morning as we look at these words. And I want you to notice the first connection, the connection between prosperity and forgetfulness. The connection between prosperity and forgetfulness. Again, as we come to this second chapter, Hosea begins, or rather God begins through Hosea, to speak with more precision and more detail as to how it is that Israel had gone astray. And you'll notice that at the heart of the way in which Israel went astray was what you might call their relationship or their attitude to their things, to their possessions, to their material wealth. We see that in a number of places in these words. We see it most evidently there in verse 5. For their mother has played the whore, she who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, and then notice, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. You have six specific items listed there, each of them being coupled together with another term. You have there bread and water, representative of the food and the sustenance that these people had. You have linked together wool and flax, both of which were made for the purpose of clothing, to cover one's nakedness. And you see oil and drink, the picture there of luxury, the picture there of surplus, of those things in this life that we delight in and enjoy. You see, it emphasized again in verse 8. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold. You see, brothers and sisters, as we begin to understand the unfaithfulness of Israel, at the center of Israel's unfaithfulness is a relationship to material possessions. And the picture that is being painted even in these few words for us, the picture that is being given is simply this: that Israel at this time in history was a people, a nation, a church that was tremendously prosperous. They were overflowing with abundance. This is not the picture of a people begging for crumbs of bread on their hands and knees, but a people who had more than they knew what to do with. Which is actually one of the reasons, as we will see and continue our time here in Hosea, that the ministry of Hosea primarily fell on deaf ears. A prosperous people saying, Hosea comes and says, we're gonna come to destruction, but look at the lives we're living. Look at the opulence. Look at how much we have. The people of Israel were a prosperous people, flourishing in every way. To summarize it, the people of Israel are pictured here as really having all that their hearts desired. But, and this is so key to understanding this prophecy, what is it that happened? Though they were a prosperous people, what happened? Again in verse 5, for their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. In verse 8, it's put with a little more clarity. She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold. what had happened to this prosperous people. In verse 13, she went after her lovers and forgot me. This prosperous people, so blessed by God, had forgotten God. Israel had allowed, if I can put it this way, Israel had allowed the gifts to eclipse the giver. And brothers and sisters, this connection between prosperity and forgetfulness is one that demands our special attention. Why? Because for as prosperous as Israel was in these days, brothers and sisters, without exaggeration, there has perhaps been no time in the history of humanity where people have enjoyed as much prosperity as you and I. Economic prosperity, political prosperity, freedoms and enjoyments. We live in a day and age, we live in a time, brothers and sisters, unique to the history of humanity, where you and I, in our first world comfort, have everything we want. I know there are people who struggle with their budgets and to live paycheck to paycheck. But brothers and sisters, there has never been a time in history where there has been a group of people so marked by prosperity as you and I. And the prosperity that we enjoy and the prosperity that we take for granted. And we need to see the connection this morning between prosperity and forgetfulness. Because it is not a law etched in stone, but the Bible does tell us that by and large, the majority of the time, a prosperous people is a people who will and do forget God. You remember the way in which this comes to us, perhaps? In Proverbs chapter 30. In the very book that teaches us the depths of biblical wisdom. And what does the wise teacher say? In Proverbs chapter 30, verses 8 and 9, he says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches." Why would he say that? We probably identify pretty quickly, "God, don't give me poverty." Why does the wise teacher say to God, "Neither give me riches"? Well, he immediately adds in Proverbs 30, verse 9, "Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with what is necessary, lest I be full and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?'" You see, what biblical wisdom is teaching us is that there is often, again, not a law that is etched in stone, but by and large, the experience that the Bible brings us to think upon is this: a prosperous people is often a people who forget God, who revel in the gifts, all the while forgetting the giver. Jesus himself taught this. In Matthew 19, do you remember those pointed words where Jesus says, "I tell you, it is more possible for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to inherit the kingdom of heaven." Jesus is there speaking that those who trust in the gifts, those who rely simply on the gifts, those who revel and glory in the gift all the while ignoring the giver, Jesus is saying there's no way. If you're like that you can come into the kingdom of heaven. And it's what happened to these people. So many things, so much prosperity, and they had forgotten God. And friends, we need to be warned how important it is that with our own homes and the shelter and the comfort that they provide, that they not be a reason we forget God. How important it is for all the clothes that fill our closets that we not forget God. How important with all the health that we enjoy and have in this life that it not be a reason to forget God. Woe to us, brothers and sisters, if all of our education, our degrees and our diplomas cause us to forget God. Woe to us if the food and the daily provisions that are made to you and I cause us to forget God. Brothers and sisters, don't let your gadgets and your toys be a reason to forget God. It's a mundane truth, but it's a truth nonetheless. Brothers and sisters, the smartphone in your pocket is a temptation to get you to forget God. And that's what happened to these people. They had so much. And in the midst of having so much, they failed to acknowledge and failed to thank and failed to use the gifts that God had given for their good and for His glory. Brothers and sisters, let it be all of our prayer that in the prosperity that we enjoy, we would never be a people who forget God. That's the first connection here in these words, prosperity with forgetfulness. But I want you to notice a second connection. A second connection, and that is the connection between forgetfulness and hardness. Specifically, the hardness of heart. So here Israel is a people abounding with prosperity, but the tragedy is they've forgotten God. And as they forgot God, as they failed to acknowledge Him, as they failed to live lives of gratitude, as they failed to use these gifts that He had given for their good and for His glory, what happened? Well, what we see in the text is that as they forgot God, their hearts were increasingly hardened toward God. Where do I see that? I see that specifically in verse 5. For their mother has played the whore, she who conceived them has acted shamefully. And then, brothers and sisters, mark these words. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Here the people of Israel are pictured as that wife. And she declares, I will go. And where does she go? She doesn't go to God. But she openly says, I will go after my lovers who have given me all these things. We see here, don't we, that even in forgetting God, there's a great exchange. They've exchanged God for someone and something else, which is exactly what the Apostle Paul says is true of fallen humanity in Romans chapter 1. We exchange the glory of the Creator for creation. And here she openly and boldly says, I will go after my lovers. And friends, in those few words, what a slap in the face to God. What a slap in the face. How do I begin to picture and emphasize the tragedy of these words? I remember a number of years ago, before we lived here, Rachel and I had a couple, a married couple that we were close to, some of our best friends. And they eventually moved and we moved and life becomes what it does and we lost touch with one another. And a couple years ago, I caught wind of the change in their life and in their marriage. Tragically, heartbreakingly, the wife had committed adultery, ended up leaving her husband, which in and of itself is as I've said, is a heartbreaking sin. To turn on the one that you've committed your life to and to turn on your family in that way. And that's what she had done. But I remember as I caught up on the news of what was going on with them that the situation was even more horrible than I could imagine. And that's because the adulterous relationship that she engaged in was not the way that many people engage in adultery. It wasn't done in secret. It was done flagrantly and brazenly in the open. It is so much so that what had happened one evening is that this mother had prepared a meal for her family. And they were sitting around the dinner table, and as their three children were finishing, she looked at her husband and said, "Okay, I'm done. I'm going to go down the street to a man who is not you, and I'm done with you. And I'm going to go live for his embrace." Without shame and without embarrassment, out in the open, in the most brazen way possible, she was telling her husband, "I will go to my lover." And you can imagine sitting in the seat of the husband. And the way that the heartbreak would flood. And it's a small picture of what Israel does to God. "I will go after my lovers. I will go after others. Not just one, not just two. It's in the plural. I will go after my lovers who give to me everything that is necessary for life. I will." Brothers and sisters, I don't think I need to say it this morning, but I will. That's not the language of faith. That is the language of a hardened, hardened heart. I will. I will do what I want. I will go where I want. I will be with who I want to be with. And dare I suggest this morning how many people lie spiritually dead because of those two words, "I will." If you can bear another illustration this morning, I saw this actually perfectly exemplified just this week. A longtime friend of mine, known her for over 20 years, is trying to increase a social media platform. And the very way in which she's doing it is to go on to this social media platform and talk about why it is she's no longer a Christian. She has over 10,000 followers. Hundreds of people reading and loving the stuff that she writes. At one time, one of my very best friends. And this week she wrote, and it was actually as I was preparing for this very message, and I saw that she had written on one of her social media platforms this confession, she said, of an ex-Christian. And she said, "Many people ask me why it is that I'm no longer a Christian. And here's the answer. I'm no longer a Christian because the God of Christianity doesn't give me my autonomy," a fancy word for independence. And she said, "The God of Christianity doesn't let me be and do who I want to be and what I want to do. The God of Christianity sets limits so that I don't have my freedom." And in the context of that post, It had everything to do with what she called bodily autonomy, to use her body any way she wanted. And hundreds of people loving her and praising her for her courage and her fearlessness. This is her grand argument against God. He doesn't let me do what I want. But it's the language that we find here. I will. I will do what I want. I will go where I want. Forget God. And friends, it is not the language of faith. It is the language of the hardness of heart. You know, James writes in his letter, doesn't he, in the most minute way. A Christian, how does a Christian live? A Christian doesn't live by saying tomorrow I will go here or I will go there. But you remember what James says. No, we say if the Lord wills it. The language of faith demonstrated in the Garden of Gethsemane on the eve of his crucifixion, where Jesus wrestles with the reality of his coming death. And he resigns himself. Not what I will, but what you will. Friends, if you're living your life in the obstinacy of I will do what I want, I will spend my money how I want to spend my money, I will spend my time how I want to spend my time, I will do with my relationships what I want to do with my relationships, friends, that is not a demonstration of the sensitivity of faith, but the hardness of heart. And that's what Israel is doing. I will live on my own terms. Forget God. I will do what I will do. It's the connection between forgetfulness and hardness. But thirdly, more briefly this morning, I want you to notice the connection between hardness and affliction. Hardness and affliction. So here again, the picture is Israel's a very prosperous people. In all of their prosperity, they've forgotten God. As they have forgotten God, they have been given over to the hardness of heart. Then what? What happens after that? Well, we read it, don't we, in verses 6 and 7. There in verse 5, for she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. And then in verse 6, the I will of the obstinate sinner is met by the I will of God. And God says, therefore I will hedge up her way with thorns. Now sometimes that expression, to put a hedge around, it means protect, doesn't it? You can think of Job chapter 1 when Satan comes into the presence of God, and he wants Job to be turned over into his hands. He says, God, the only reason that Job serves and honors you is because you've hedged him up. That's the language Satan uses. You put a hedge of protection around him. You've given him so much. But notice the characteristic here in the sixth verse of the hedge that God will hedge her up with. He says, I will hedge her up with thorns. Well, hedge her up with thorns. Just earlier this summer, I was trying to trim a bush in my yard. Some kind of funky vine was growing all in it and through it. And I thought, well, this will be easy enough. I'll just reach my hands in there and I'll grab that vine out and I'll just tear it out and make this bush look a little better. And I reached in there without giving it the attention I probably should have and very quickly found out that the vine that was growing was a thorn vine. And there were giant thorns in it, and I sunk my hands into it, and I immediately pulled back, cut and scraped and bleeding, because that's what thorns do. And God is saying, that's what I'm going to do. As my people, as my bride, says, I will go and pursue other lovers. God says, I'm going to hedge her up with thorns. I'm going to hedge her in with thorns so that as she goes after those lovers, she's going to get pricked and she's going to get cut and she's going to get scraped And she might even bleed a little. And if that's not enough, God says, not only there in the sixth verse, I will hedge her way with thorns. He says, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. So she can't do what she wants to do. In the seventh verse, she will pursue her lovers, but not overtake them, and she shall seek them, but shall not find them. God is saying, that's how I'm going to protect my bride, so that she doesn't go headlong into sin, so that she doesn't give herself to the embrace and the love of another. I'm going to hedge her in, and it's going to hurt, and she's going to suffer, and she's going to feel it. But I'm doing it to protect her, to keep her from wandering into the paths of sin. Friends, have you ever thought of your afflictions in those terms? Have you ever thought of the trials and the hurt that you experience in this life as a thorn, so to speak, sent by God to keep you out of the path of sin? Your life isn't what you want it to be. Maybe God's doing something to keep you from the sin your heart desires. No, we cannot infallibly interpret every affliction. But brothers and sisters, please don't be disappointed by every disappointment in your life. Don't be discouraged by every discouragement that falls along your path, because it may very well be God hedging you in to keep you from the very sin that would bring you to utter ruin. God meets the hardness of his people's heart with affliction. And finally, very briefly this morning, is the connection then between affliction and remembering. What's the design of it all? Prosperous Israel forgets God. As they forget God, they grow hardened in heart. As they are hardened in heart, God hedges them in. What is the purpose? Well, look with me at the end of verse 7. Then, right, after God hedges her in with thorns, after he builds her a wall so that she cannot find her paths, so she cannot overtake her lovers, so that she cannot be satisfied in her sins, in verse 7, then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. What's the point of it all? It's to get her to remember. It's to get her to remember, to come to terms with the dissatisfaction of sin, and to remember, brothers and sisters, that it is always, always, always better to be with God. What is it Augustine, the ancient church father, said? Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. And God is saying, here's the way I'm going to work against this hardened people. I will afflict them, and I will afflict them in order that they might remember it is better with me. It's the same thing the prodigal son said in a far distant off country. After he had squandered his inheritance and lived in the delights and the pleasures of this world, he says, it is better for me to be a servant in my father's house. I had it way better there. It's the same thing the psalmist teaches us to sing. Where is it? Psalm 84, I think verse 10. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of the wicked. God is causing this affliction and causing this hurt and causing this pain to wake his bride and his people up to the simple fact that it is always better with God. With his kindness and his mercy and his grace and his patience. With all that he has shown us in Jesus Christ. Friends, I want you to know this morning that it is better to be poor with Jesus than it is to have all the riches of this world without him. It is better to be weak with Jesus than it is to be strong without him. It is better to be hated with Jesus by all people than to be loved without him. Friends, I want you to know it is infinitely better to be broken with Jesus than to be whole without him. The least of God's kindness and grace is infinitely better than all this world has to offer. And if the Lord is willing, we will see more of that next week. What it is that we have with God. But brothers and sisters, here we perceive the mysterious mind of God, whose ways are higher than ours, whose thoughts are higher than ours, that he would afflict his bride in such a way that she would remember it is better with him than all the pleasures of this world. Let's pray.